Well, hi, everybody. This is Mark Ciaffardini. Welcome back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Hope your summer's going well. Hope you're enjoying the movies.
And now, a message from AMC Theaters.
It's been a while. For the past year, the roads have been a little empty. But we're starting to see the promise of a new day.
Yo. I'm Vin Diesel. For more than 100 years, there's one place where we all came together to be entertained. The movies. There's nothing like it. The popcorn, the previews, the pretzels. And don't forget, the movies.
We are excited beyond belief to speak to our next guest, returning composer Brian Tyler. You know him if you ever tried to escape a room, you ever wanted to surf the Hawaii sunset, ride in off in a vintage Ferrari, or just fly through the sky like Iron Man. How good do you think you look? Just know you'll never have hair better than Brian Tyler. Brian, welcome back to the show. How you been, buddy?
I've been great. How you doing?
Fantastic. Fantastic. It's I kind of thought that 2021 would have been better than 2020. It's got its ups and downs. How's things in your world?
Yeah, it's wild. Because, you know, one of the things that was really a tough part of 2020, of course, being the pandemic holding us all in and not being able to go anywhere and socialize or do anything. And that it felt like we had kind of an opening there. And in terms of music, you know, it's things are looking real good and movies are coming out and tours are starting to be booked. But then like in the last week or so, that's got a little discombobulated and things kind of thrown into question about how much things are going to be touring. And you know, for musicians, we love to get out there and play live. And you know, of course, part of the experience is just being with people, either in the movie theater or at a concert hall. So we'll see. It's been, you know, it's in terms of like the musical side or the artistic side, it's been interesting. And there's been definitely a lot of good things about it, you know, in terms of making lemonade from lemons. But you know, I just like being around people. So just from a personal perspective, you know, I'm hoping that this continues to get us there, you know.
Totally. Yeah, I remember speaking to Nick Jurata last year, and you know, he, like you said, musicians just sort of thrive on that live experience with the audience. You know, I've seen some of the photos and videos from your Mad Sonic concerts. What's it like standing in front of, I'm going to say 50, 60,000 people where everyone, you've got everyone's ears? What's that?
Yeah, it's, that is a singular experience. I mean, it's funny. It's so crazy the feedback you get from the crowd that you almost don't even, it's going to sound counterintuitive, but it becomes intimate because it's like they're it all kind of becomes like this big unit and you feel really communal, like really communal. And you know, you're looking, I tend to look it over on the edge and see people, you know, rocking out and having fun. And then you see, you know, like kind of like in an emotional moment, it is incredible to see how people react so similarly across lines. In terms of, you know, getting up there, it's just such a rush. I often get asked, like, is it nerve-wracking getting up in front of a lot of people, and like it's always kind of, there's always an amount of nerves getting in front of anybody, but I have I kind of had the same amount of those. They're kind of like good nerves, I'd say. It's like an excitement of whether or not it's a you know, big arena or it's like 10 people just at my studio, and I'm playing a, you know, performing a piano concerto, you know. So it for us, like, I think performance wise, I think it really is, it's just wanting to connect to the people, whether it's 1, 5, 10, 20, 20,000, you know.
So, you know, there's this great line in Three Kings where George Clooney is talking to Spike Jones, and he basically says that, well, you do the thing you're scared of and you get the courage afterwards. So I imagine that you have, you know, having an audience and people who know your brand versus, like, let's say you meet up with a first, you know, first meeting with a director you've never met before. Is there more of those good, good nerves on stage, or is it a different kind of nerve when you present to somebody you've never worked with before?
You know, I find that, when you go, if you're talking about directly those two comparisons, when I meet a new director, it's like meeting anybody. You just want to kind of get where they're coming from and see what they're like. And it's just, I find it to be, you know, a meeting of the minds, and you see if you vibe. So, you know, you get that kind of feedback, and in a way playing for, you know, in concert or whatnot, it is certainly, the communication is two ways. I think people often think if you're on stage, it's a one-way thing, but I so feed off the crowd and then the audience, and how, you know, it's very personal to me. And that's why I always really do my best to try to, I spend hours kind of talking to people afterwards and meeting people and seeing where they're coming from. And if they, you know, it's always amazing, especially like after, you know, either playing at a music festival or playing or conducting a concert of my music and meeting people afterwards and finding, you know, their story. And it's funny, there was one time, actually, there was, this is kind of tangential but related. There was one time I did a concert in London, and it was on my film scoring side, and I conducted the Philharmonia out there at the Royal Festival Hall. And I had, there was an after party. It just, you know, for the orchestra and press and people that I knew and all sorts of things. And that went on for hours and hours. And so probably about 3 a.m. or so, I went to go back to my hotel room. And I was with the kind of the security and different people, and we went out the artist exit or entrance or whatever it's called. And there was a bunch of people still waiting there for me, like a pretty good group. I'm sure there was a bigger group earlier in there, but these are the ones that stayed for, you know, 4 hours, five, I don't know, long time. And I started to say hi and sign some things, and I wanted to talk to them. And someone from the security team or something, I don't remember who it was, they kind of like grabbed me and like, oh no, we got to go, Mr. Tyler. You know, and they kind of shuffled me off to my driver that was waiting for me. And I zoomed off, and I blew past all these people that were waiting there for me. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the greatest concerts I'd ever experienced. Except all I could think about were those people, and that I blew by them, and it really bothered me. And it haunted me. And I remember going back and being in my hotel room and being like pretty like crushed, and that's, I couldn't, you know people were like, oh my gosh, that was amazing, remember you conducting that one piece, and then you had like all these standing ovations and they're all the great. Now all I could think about was like, yeah, but you know, and it really haunted me. So cut to like, I think 2 years later, played the same venue in London conducted it, and I was gonna make, well, sure, if someone was going to be waiting for me, I don't know if I'd used up all my goodwill and no one was going to be waiting. That's what I expected. And what I did is I, after I finished conducting, I went in and then I kind of came back out on stage about 15 minutes later. I changed into a t-shirt and whatnot. Actually, the first concert, I was in a t-shirt the whole time. But anyway, so I came back out, you know, it was like in the stage where all the orchestra was. And there was like, you know, a gazillion, like people had gone, like kind of waiting, like not knowing where I was, but they were kind of in the front. And I got down and I wanted to talk to every one of them, just kind of as like, it's almost like one, I just wanted them to talk to them, but I felt like it was penance, you know, also, but talking to them, signing things. And there was, I remember there was this young lady in a wheelchair. And I was like, I think I remember walking right past her 2 years ago. And I went up to her and she had like a picture of me and like some albums and I signed stuff, and I was like, and she told me, she's like, I was there 2 years ago waiting, you know, in the cold. And I mean, literally it was cold. I was England, you know, it was London. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I totally remember you. I'm so glad it came. It made me feel so much better thinking that maybe there's a chance that all those people were back. So I did the party after party, and then I left out the same entrance later in the night, and sure enough, there's a group of people and awaiting. Some of them were the same, and they had been waiting so long, they actually told me the story, and I stopped and I did not go. I talked to every single one of them, and I remember the stories of how they're like, yeah, we were here, a lot of them were here the last time, and I said, you know, I felt so bad. And they're like, oh no, it was fine, that's okay, because they're all from like Japan and Denmark and Spain. And as it turns out, they waited so long that they all became friends and they exchanged information. And then they all, this, the second concert, they all came back, and then they kind of did it as a trip. Like they become friends outside of it. And so they wanted to try it again. So it was a nice ending, but I'm not sure where I got this from, but the idea of getting up in front of people and what it means and the intimacy of being in a crowd versus a single person, be it a director or a friend or whoever that you're playing music for, the line of difference is much thinner than one would think. And there's a long story to show it.
That's phenomenal. I'm going to clip that out. That's going to be its own little YouTube clip of that. It just shows you how much Brian cares. He puts heart into his scores, puts heart into his music, yeah, because he actually has a heart. That's sensational, man. Thanks for that.
Of course.
Well, let's talk. You got three movies this year. The two, and I mean, year's only half over. You got three on the books. So you got To Those Who, yep, Wish Me Dead, you got F9, and you got Escape Room Tournament of Champions. We're going to focus on the last two. Let's just jump right into F9. I mean, six at-bats to this franchise, nine installments. You've got two-thirds of the musical notes in this series. How do you reinvent yourself? How do you, is it seven? I'm miscounting.
Yeah. Well, okay, so, I mean, music's in eight of them. The only one that's not in it is two, Fast Two. So it's kind of funny. I was involved, even though I didn't know I was involved with the first Fast and Furious. So it was, my music was licensed into it, my score and some tunes and stuff. So I didn't know that till the very end. I think I was scoring the movie Frailty at the time.
Oh yeah,
and
that was a good one.
And then by coincidence, Rob Cohen, the director of Fast and Furious 1, was mixing the movie literally next door. I was at a facility where there's two big theater mixing stages where you do all the sound, and we were at the same time mixing Frailty, I think, and Bass, however it was, like, as and they're like, oh my god, we've been looking for you, we've been using your music, and you know, this was as a little, maybe it was a little harder to get all the people, I don't know, anyway, so it was in there. And then in six, of course, like but it was really wild, because I they used my music, they used the themes that there was the music had to be like in Europe, like there's a European tax thing or something, so it had to be like re-recorded and done by someone else, something, but it was really cool. I actually really liked that movie, but it was like the easiest gig I ever had, because you know, I went to the theater and I name blows by and like the credits thing, and like you know, based on themes of, and then you hear your themes interpreted by someone else, which is so, like, it's actually really fun. Like, I highly recommend, if you're ever writing a movie franchise, try that out once. But anyway, so that was six. But then, yeah, in terms of like being the main composer, yeah, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, so here we are in 9, and Justin Lin is back, and Justin and I have been, you know, I mean, we've been together since, before Fast and Furious 3, because, which, you know, we did Annapolis together at Disney, and then he's like, hey man, I'm going over this meeting. It was when we were on Annapolis. I'm going over this meeting at Universal. There's going to be a Fast and Furious movie, but it's not the same cast. It's going to be in Japan, and so it's kind of like a spinoff, I guess. We didn't really know what it would be, and we certainly did not think at the time that it would go all the way to here. But the cool thing about 9 is that there are things that I talked about with Justin back in 2006, I guess, or 7, when we were doing Fast 3, Tokyo Drift, that were long game backstory things. So Justin is really, really takes it seriously, and it's awesome. I mean, he is no joke, you know. And he sketched out all of these diagrams, you know, this really complex backstory. And there was stuff that it hasn't been, that took this long to kind of come to fruition, the 9th movie. And I'm thinking, like, if it goes this far, and it sure, and it has, I mean, who would have thought? I mean, what other franchises, that it's like Star Wars and James Bond or something. Like, there's really not, and those, and that's, you know, Bond is a new story each time in terms of a continuous storyline. It's pretty wild. So the fact is that for anyone that's like interested in the musical aspect and the score aspect of these movies, they've become more and more along the lines of score films, whereas at the beginning it's a little bit lighter fare. It's the amount of songs that dominate the soundtrack are higher percentage, especially so the further back you go, kind of more songs, less score, and then it's tilted the other way. And now, because it becomes so dramatic and there's so many themes, and it becomes really something that you need to dig your teeth into musically. And I think the thing that I find always surprising and or not me, other people find surprising is actually, if you like listen to the scores, how very thematic it is, and it's like emotional based, and yes, there's action, and there's kind of, you know, I use my production side, my hip hop side and electronic music side to imbue itself into there, but really at its heart, it's I mean, the main theme of Fast 9 is an adagio, you know, and that is the main theme that you hear throughout the movie most. And which is Visions of the Past, the first piece, the last piece on the soundtrack. And so, you know, I think that's a surprise. The piece suite from Fast 4, the Letty music, all the Brian and Mia, they're really emotion-based, thematic, melodic, leitmotif-driven pieces that you would find. It's interesting. I was pointing that piece suite. I'm being very specific, so maybe someone will go, ooh, maybe I should, suite, S-U-I-T-E, go back. And I played it for a group of filmmakers that were here at my studio a week ago, and not saying what it was. And it is viola, solo violins, the cello, harp, and French horn done in a very classical. It's all written on paper. There's no electronics. It's all the themes of kind of Fast that are kind of go together, and it relates to Fast 9. But it was interesting playing that piece. I was like, what do you know? What this would be from? Can you imagine what movie this would be from? And Aris, filmmaker, great filmmaker and cinematographer, director, was, you know, they were all kind of scratching their heads, going, look, you do so many different kinds of movies, so it's going to be hard to say. So I don't know which it would be, but the thing they all kind of settled on would be like something along the lines of like a World War II tragic story, like along the lines of like a Schindler's List or something like that. It's found like kind of Williams, but it's very you, but it's very emotional. There's kind of a Anyway, so this is they kind of landed on historical tragic drama about as something that actually happened in history. That's kind of what they settled on. When I said it was Fast and Furious 4, they're like, "What the?" So I think this is to say that it is the book that is judged most by its cover in my career, unfairly in terms of what it does kind of musically. And I think it's because people have in their idea that very people like to put things in easy boxes just to remember things. So it's by natural selection, that's how we are. And so it was nice for on the 9th to come in and have a main theme, like the main theme, you can't escape it, be something that is truly melodic and emotional, which is really my wheelhouse, because my wheelhouse is that. My wheelhouse is not action music. Wouldn't be the first thing that if I'm writing in a vacuum, I would never write action music. Like I enjoy it and I do it and I really try to imbue it with storytelling, like, you know, and melody and all that. But in terms of something, when I sit down just at, like, for art's sake, just to compose, it's probably the furthest thing out from what I am naturally. So I think in a way that's why I think Fast and me are a really good fit, because I'm not doing necessarily like I can pull, I kind of pull the center over to this side of it in terms of the emotion. And I think there's a symbiotic relationship with that. And it's great working with a director like Justin, because he leans into that too, as crazy and wild and wacky as Fast can get. Like, you, at the heart of it, those moments are really what kind of hold it together.
Certainly. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think it, forgive me, but da 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 da. So that's like 10, 11 notes almost, maybe between 9 and 10 notes.
Yeah. And then it does this, yeah, there's like the B section, and then it does this like modulation and this kind of other kind of variation on it that really like if you listen to the first track on the it kind of does it in its entirety, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The way it works in various pieces, like sometimes you hear it during over action, but sometimes it's just like in a purely adagio string form with brass and strings. And it can be very stern, and then it's really delicate and played on the piano at times, solo, just piano. And then there's this part in the movie that I really love. It's probably my favorite part of the movie. It is on the soundtrack that was playing at home, is Visions of the Past. And it's when the character of Dom goes back in time and he sees himself as a child, and he sees how he sees his father hiding things from him and kind of almost reliving those moments. And he sees his brother, his younger brother. And I think those are the moments that like shine. It's an emotional thing. He also sees his own son somehow gets, this is like a near death experience. It's actually as he's on the edge of death, he has these, you know, that kind of like the life flashing before your eyes kind of thing, except that this actually goes into the story of solving some of the mysteries which we have wondered about since Fast One. And so the idea and the fact that Universal and the producers and Justin all like really held strong to, we're going to mix this differently than in most action films, where the music is prominent and it is the thing that tells the story through that whole sequence and other sequences too. For instance, at the beginning of the movie, when you see their flashes back, you see the father's crash in the race and he passes away. The fact that you have all these cars zooming around and there is nothing except music, you know, and that theme shows you how much that they that there's a really respectful working environment for me as a composer there with Justin and the studio, and which is really cool because it could definitely, the odds of that being a theme, like that kind of thing being a theme in that franchise, if you go back to the first one, it's like 1 in a billion. There's like no chance that that's going to be the case. Like if you're just critiquing So the evolution, it shows you how like this series has really evolved. Even though we're, you know, we're OG gang, you know, we've been there, but we've evolved with it, and it's pretty cool. And talking about the whole thing, you know, you hear about it's family and you know, all that kind of thing. It really is, like, in terms of the people that make the movies, we go way back. I mean, I think I'm one of the, I might be, Justin and I think are the ones that now have been around the longest, probably. Meh. I mean, yeah, like it's wild. Even when people that came on like Fast Five and stuff feel like they're like, wow, I've known you forever. But I mean, you go back to Fast Three, it's like insane. So it's definitely a gift. It's been great. Misunderstood sometimes out there in the world of talking to people. I've done, and it's cool that you just saying that, because I have done a lot of interviews about in kind of the more mainstream you go to, like, it depends, like, if people really know, it's always cool to know when someone knows their stuff. But you know, you do interviews with magazine or TV show or something, and I mean, the first thing they go is just like, how is it writing music that is, you know, action music for cars that are, you know, like they go straight to the like Captain Obvious, like, oh really, there's cars in it? It's kind of like it's kind of an insult, like, to the they don't mean anything by it. But I mean, you can imagine if you know, James Horner was talking about Titanic, or you know, he's gonna do it, and he's doing an interview for it, and all they could talk about is like, how is it writing music for giant boats? You know, like, what?
I can't help but laugh. This is terrible.
Like, right? You know, I was like, yeah, there's a boat in it. Like, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not Titanic, but like, you can, like, it's like, guys, can you get past the most obvious, like, dumbest, you know, association with it, and maybe see that, gosh, the music's actually going to be talking about how he has this son and like through the time, how he is the woman he loves doesn't even know, because she, like, she had a trauma and lost her, all the stuff that, like, it ties together. And the fact that Han came back, what a great thing, and cool, like the, you know, the love they have for him, and all those things are like a big part of it. But anyway, that's what I think.
Well, you know, it's funny. Because you get in a situation like that, you go, what are you new? Do your job. You're a journalist. You know, dig deeper. But, you know, speaking of family, speaking of, you know, like, one of my, it's.
Oh, I hear B.
Oh, that is a lawnmower. So.
Oh, but, it's a lawnmower in the key of B minor.
Yeah. Yeah. They chose of all times today, 2 days late, to come do the lawn. They do it right outside my window.
Should we do a thing with them?
Yeah.
Okay. There we go. Anyway, sorry.
One of my favorite tracks, you know, my favorite track on the entire F9 is Enjoying the Moment, which, as Steve Jablonski told me one time, he says that when he knows that a theme is working is when he can slow it down and put it through its paces, whether it's a somber theme. So what I love about Enjoying the Moment, it's kind of plays to your strengths as a guitarist. It takes the heartfelt theme that you did and, you know, puts it through a more of emotional filter. But is it true that, you know, it's only a good theme that can work in those variations? You know, what's your take on that?
Steve's right. I'm going to take Steve's point and put some sauce on it. Basically, I think it works in both directions. So totally right. If you can slow it down, basically, I would say a theme really, where I really try to find a theme, and I find it lands in the where I feel I've gotten it. One, it has to feel just emotionally right. It needs to be one of those things like, damn, that feels good, just like as a musical thematic thing. And so playing it, slowing it down and doing it on a different instrument, like a piano or a guitar or something really quiet, if it's something that's like a large theme that's otherwise really big and triumph or whatever, you can pare down and do that. He's right. Then you're onto something. Here's the sauce. I also, something that's very difficult, but I always try to do is with the theme, you never know if this movie you're going to do is going to be a franchise, or the character is going to continue beyond the story that you are looking at. And because of that, I always try to write themes that can turn tonally into its own opposite, but keep the same melody, but by changing the chords a little bit. Because it may be that this character, let's take the extreme example, your hero becomes the villain in the next movie. You need to keep the same theme. And so the idea of being able to have a theme that is the same melody that represents joy and inspiration can also sound like tragedy and heartbreak, and as well as heroism and villainy, to be able to hit all these things depending on how you play one theme, to me that's a very, very high bar, and it's a difficult thing to do, but it is a necessary thing to do. And in terms of that, you really want to strive for that at least. And it's cool that you picked that out, because that is one of my favorites for sure as well.
Yeah. Well, is this another one of your favorites? Buck from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There's something about, like, there's such an emotional beat to that. And I go, Tyler, son of a bitch, I'm crying.
Yeah. Buck, you know, it's funny. A lot of people have written me about that piece. There's something kind of endemically aspirational. Yeah, I really love that one. You know who loves that one is the director too. That was one of those ones that I had written something different for the scene, I remember. And I'd already played it for him. And he loved it. It was great. He's like, oh, good. And then I thought of this other, like, kind of in my sleep, like Buck, like, popped into my head. It's kind of like weird, funnily named. It's one of those things that, like, it has kind of a goofy name because of what they say in the scene to make it go, but the music itself is very much like kind of powerful in a way, you know, it has that awe and like wonderment, like I love that kind of fire inside kind of feel that's very emotional. But anyway, I thought of it like I literally woke up like from a dream and was like, oh no, I have something else. So I went back and rewrote the scene. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, look, Jonathan, I know we already approved this scene, but this is like the thing you know, if you want to make your life easy, don't do this. But it was the right thing to do. I was like, look, I think this is better. We've been listening to this other thing for a month. Can I just play this? And I played, and he was like, what? You know, it ended up being, it was absolutely one of his favorites. And in fact, I was just kind of coming up with a list of for my concert tours when I conduct, and I always like to kind of pull ones that aren't the main theme from a movie here and there that people might not even realize kind of, and that's on the list.
Well, I'm you know, there's something you said a little while ago. You said that you wouldn't write action music if that was, you know, if you had your choice. So, you know, everybody seems to, you know, sometimes perception's reality. I'm glad you told us that little what's behind the curtain. But when someone comes to you and somebody goes like, you're Brian Tyler, you're this guy, or, you know, John Williams is the French horn guy. Like, what, when someone comes to you, what do they say? Like, yeah.
Like, okay, so I'll give an example. I was just Tuesday. I was walking down Hollywood Boulevard, Hollywood Boulevard. Yeah, I was going into the offices there. There's a production company right there. I have a meeting, and I came out, and I'll just give you all the details. So I was eating. I got one of those LA street dogs. I love those hot dogs. There's like bacon wrapped hot dog with like the grilled onion and the like the peppers and like the it's like it's just the craziest hot dog. It's awesome. But they're like, you know, the locals, like they're everywhere, you know, they're like little food stands. So I got my, I was like, yeah, you know, you walk by, it smells like, you know, like amazing. And so I have my hot dog. This is going somewhere. And so I'm just in hot dog bacon heaven, just like, and it's hot out and everything. I don't care. I'm like having this thing and just like eating on the street corner. It's like, yeah. And then I'll, you know, all of a sudden this group of guys comes up to me and you're Brian Tyler, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, oh, cool. You know, I was like, but I kind of got half hot dog going on. I got like, you know, like mustard on my face. And so what they're like, they started talking about things, and it was really kind of interesting. They were all they're young, 20 something, like 22, I don't know, something like that. And they're talking about, they all started telling me about, they weren't from this country either. They're, I think, from Italy or something. And they're talking about how, like, their favorite scores, and they were all over the map. Like, one, it was a really interesting, almost not like they were arguing with each other, but kind of like, oh, you know what I love is da da da. And they'd say like, oh, the Iron Man 3 theme. And like, it's so, you know, robust. And like, then the other guy's like, in the kind of like contradictory, like, have you heard Yellowstone though? And like, it's like, you know, it's like cello. And they kind of got in this weird, like, and then, oh yeah, one of the guys like super into like kind of electronic ambient. And they mentioned things like Escape Room and then like Far Cry, the violin solo that I did on Far Cry, and the Assassin's Creed kind of like Irish jig music. And then the guy, oh, did you know about the greatest game ever played? It turned into this whole like, I'm like basically not saying anything. I'm just like kind of finishing my hot dog. But it was really cool. And it turns out that there were different musicians. One was like, was a cellist. So he actually, like, by trade, that's like his job. And so he gravitates towards Yellowstone because the theme is like a cello, you know, and some of my more chamber music pieces. And you could kind of see their backgrounds in it, but they're all friends. And it just happens to be like, so I got, so it's always weird to kind of, and by the way, a short addendum on that. It took a picture and I saw the picture eventually. And of course, like, it was like, I'm smiling. I have like a giant, like pepper in my tooth. It looks like I'm missing this tooth. Like, I have no tooth here. Anyway. In terms of like kind of getting boxed in, it is one of the most frustrating things that I could, because truly all my life, I have been pulled in different directions. Like, it totally makes sense. If you go back to even my childhood, I loved playing piano, a certain kind of romantic style of piano, Liszt, Rachmaninoff, Chopin, their scherzos, you know, like the Chopin, you know, B minor, all those, Rachmaninoff, I watched the Von Cliburn competition. And I was like, I loved piano, everything from shredding to the very quiet and like, and I to this day, I love it. That's why I have like multiple Steinways, you know, like I reinvest in my piano love. Here's the thing. I was a drummer and I loved jazz and like kind of progressive metal and progressive music, everything from, you know, Meshuggah and that kind of thing, Tool, to like Rush and progressive and Chick Corea. And then going all the way back, like in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s jazz, all the way through like Frank Zappa's type of thing. So that was on the drums. But then you also take into account, I loved electronics and I Depeche Mode and hip hop and like Public Enemy and anything that kind of, it's like the idea of that kind of really raw, cool music being produced, especially hip hop, came from the scarcity and the idea of where it came from and not being able to really get musicians as much. So drum machines were used in 808, kind of the more budget ones like 808s and TRI, all those kind of things. Those became the sound of what cool was because it was more affordable and it was cooler and people were more innovative and pioneering. And I love that angle of it. So I was like a hip hop kid. And so in that, and also like kind of British new wave, as it was called, like with early electronic music that became electronic music, but hip hop too. So these things were like it would be like someone that played multiple sports or something like that. It's not that crazy of an idea to be like, hey, I play basketball and football. And, you know, in this case, it would be, you know, some third one. You know, I'm a swimmer or whatever. It doesn't seem that crazy as me growing up doing that, but it seems to be crazy to other people now that I followed all of those and completely invested myself in not kind of having a casual understanding of how to produce electronic or hip hop music or a casual understanding of what it means to do chamber music versus kind of music like Bartok or the Polish New Wave in the 20th century classical music, all those things, like the idea that all those things are pursuits that or jazz that I took to heart and lived to try to deconstruct and find better ways for me to write that music, somehow is lost on people and they want to put you in one category. So when they hear something like Crazy Rich Asians, that it's this like, it's almost like 1950s style romance on strings combined with late 40s, early 50s big band jazz that's all written new, they're like, you did that? Wow, you're the guy that did that song with Wiz Khalifa, aren't you? You know what I mean? And vice versa. And it's so crazy to me. I mean, granted, most people do kind of find more of a lane. I'm kind of way out on the extreme of like it's like a kid in the candy store when it comes to like, I'm going to learn that kind of music. You know, I it's like a challenge. But the cool thing about film is it allows you to move around. And directors that know me know these, you know, they know this. And I've been really fortunate. Like right now, I mean, it's a great example. Right now, if you just put pause on this day, right, of what's going on. I just had Those Who Wish Me Dead released, which is Taylor Sheridan directing. And that music is a really could be... kind of like a minimalist classical kind of style score, but intermixed with some electronic instruments that I feel are like analog 1979 style type of thing that really could be like a performance, like a concert performance. Then you have Escape Room, Fast Nine, which is of course Fast and Furious, and Escape Room, which is purely industrially electronic, like drum and bass, industrial, mixed with like IDM and that kind of thing. And then I recorded Redeeming Love, which the whole thing is a violin concerto. Gil Shaham, my favorite violinist in the world, who's John Williams' violinist for concerts, who does Schindler's List live in the concert and everything. He's the violinist. It's Vienna Symphony, and it's a tragic 18th century or 19th century story of love and loss. And like you put these together, and then doing Rescue Rangers was an animated film for Disney, and then Olympus, which is I'm directing. All these things are so different. Like for me being kind of whinging about being boxed in by when I talk to people casually and saying you're this, or even in an interview or whatever, it's nice to see that actually I'm getting hired to do things that have nothing to do with each other in terms of stylistically. So while you do get boxed in, and even music executives at studios, believe it or not, still will say, aren't you the action guy or whatever? And like, did you see Crazy Rich Asians? It's a pretty big hit, you know, just that one. Just, you know, it's amazing. But I think often there's in any field, there's good and there's bad. There's people that do their homework and there's people that aren't. And there's people that actually live what they do as a career instead of just kind of are a resident sitting in a chair. And those are the people that really do know. So, you know, it's a complicated, I guess, answer to a question that I deal with every day. So I have kind of a lot to say about it. But there you go. Put it in a blender. No, it is something that follows me every day of my life for sure. But I'll just keep going.
Yeah, I'm glad. Well, put it in a blender. Put it in that leaf blower that's blowing behind me. I don't know if you hear that.
I can't actually hear it. You got a good noise cancellation system. I only heard that. I only heard the lawnmower in B minor earlier. So.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but I do want to pick your brain in two aspects.
Okay.
One of them, you've got a slew of, I think they're BMI awards behind you. Unless that's even more. There's an amazing picture of you with Alan Silvestri, Thomas Newman. If you can remember that, what was that? Yeah. Can you tell us some about that? What was that night like?
Yeah. That it was James Newton Howard was in it too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love that photo.
Yeah. It's awesome. It's funny. We were all just kind of talking, you know, they're all friends of mine which is cool because for me as a coming into it as a film scoring fan, you know, and getting into film composing and listening to all of them, you know, on all my, you know, as long as I can remember Tom and Alan and Jim and you know, that like And you know, I think David's in it as well. I think David Newman. And the idea that I'm friends with these people now is really crazy to me. And we were just kind of, we were going to be in my awards. I was getting some awards. Let's say like from here to here. And it was a year that I got a bunch, I remember. And we're just talking about life. Like, what's up? You know, I haven't seen you since like the last show. Like, you know, like just kind of like, you know, shooting the breeze and catching up and being friends and laughing and everything. And I remember the photographer came over and was just like, hey, you guys want to get a picture? And like, it was like, you kind of usually don't get that many composers in like in one photo. And we're like, yeah. So it actually was like catching a moment that was like just a real moment of hanging out, almost like, you know, getting a drink and like catching up with friends. And I remember for me, from my perspective, it was just such a lovely moment thinking like, wow, this is pretty cool. They like, one, the fact they even know who I am, but the fact that they're friends and we talk to each other and, you know, and Tom Newman and I, like we shared, you know, like we years, like shared Lakers seats. Like we trade off, we had season tickets and we trade off and he would come over to my studio and we'd like, oh, here's the tickets. And, you know, and just like seeing him and his wife and J&H and like, you know, all like it's crazy to me. And Alan is so, I mean, it's just been such a cool guy and like such a good guy to me, especially, you know, like, and we've crossed over, of course, I've done, you know, I've used this Predator theme, like I did, you know, obviously Avengers and uses me. And when I did Thor, I used this Captain America theme and on and on. I got like the idea that we have actually kind of, we've worked on the same movie franchises, but he's like Alan Silvestri. And, you know, and then, you know, it's funny. And then I went and I see where we sat down for the award show. And I was actually sitting right by Alan and Tom. And so I was like, oh, hey, good to see you again. You know, they're right there at Jim and everything. But it, yeah, it's always fun to go to those things. One is kind of like, I always feel like I like my fandom kind of comes out, even fandom and friendom, you know, like you become friends and colleagues. And it's cool when they're like, they mention, hey, you know, remember them saying, it's like, it's total like deep cut, something about Partition, my score for Partition, you know, like, you know, like, oh, that reminded them of Maurice Jarre and all this stuff. And forget who it was. I think it was Tom. Yeah, I mean, that's good stuff. It's I feel very, very lucky.
Well, I think you should be. You know, the one gem that I gleaned from you one of the last times we spoke, I believe it was for either Iron Man 3 or Into the Storm, maybe Thor the Dark World. You said, yeah. Yes, we were talking about all these different franchises. And you said, yeah, it's an embarrassment of riches. So it's a good thing to have, you know, being the composer of the F1 theme, you know, the new Universal theme, you know, to
picking
up on Jerry Goldsmith, all these other things. So yeah, if young Brian Tyler was, you know, if you told yourself when you're writing Bubba Hotep, you probably wouldn't believed it. But since you have so much, I know this is gonna be a very tough question, especially because you don't like listening to your own music. If you could pick a desert island CD or vinyl of your own music, like what is the one that means the most to you, that if you had to go to a desert island, and that's all you listen to, what's the most emotional in your catalog?
Well, that one, now that one's easy, but it's kind of unfair because there's so much and it's not even out, but it would be Are We Dreaming?
Okay.
You know, there's no question. I mean, for one thing, I've done 9 hours of music for it, so it'd be a good catalog to have. But besides that, it is me at my most me, because I'm directing Are We Dreaming. So the music goes first and then the images and the shooting comes later. So it's me telling a story and narrative with music first, without it's like kind of the most pure form of my writing by far that I've ever done. So I think, and that is something that I do like, I can listen to that. Like it's funny. It's one that it is for some reason, it is different. Like, and I'm with my wife, she'll pop it on, or, you know, like she'll put it like, and I'm like it's like a thing where you, it's kind of a, it's I think it's because it's also outside of any kind of there's no politics, there's no about it, there's no it's a pure art form, you know. So I think that's what it'd be. But there's a lot of scores that I love that especially when they're older that I can listen to now and I'm like, what? Because it's I've been doing it kind of so long and I've done so many scores that often when I pop something in, I will play something, like we'll kind of do a little deep dive, you know, with a friend or something, and we'll go back to something I did 20 years ago. And it's, and I forget, you know, that it was like, I mean, I remember it comes back to me. I can conduct every little moment of it as it comes, like one moment before you remember. It's like remembering lyrics to a song. If you just said, hey, tell me the lyrics for Billie Jean right now, you'd be like, but if the song came on, you'd be able to, that kind of thing. In essence, there's that probably if I was taking a score besides Are We Dreaming, it might be something older, you know, but then I would get used to it. But yeah, I'm gonna go with Are We Dreaming.
Okay, well, on that note, the unfair, because it hasn't come out and we haven't listened to it yet, I would love to have you back on when that comes out and we can take a deep dive into it. And I was really 100%. hoping you're gonna say John dies at the end. I think that needs a little more
publicity. Yeah, I need some love. Guys, you know what, that one is so, gosh, you know what, that is a great idea. I'm gonna pop that one in, because that I did that and like I turned it around like at a time where I was like, it was really quick. But at the same time, that's what's really fun. So because I don't get used to it as much. And that one was so bizarre. And of course, it's Don Coscarelli. But I love doing Bubba Hotep, you know. And I just listened to Six String like yesterday.
Oh, because wow.
The Blu-ray special edition thing is coming out. And I did interviews for that with Lance, the director, and all that. Completely forgot about, like, you know, like almost like the, like me singing On My Way to Vegas, the end title song and all that stuff. It's just like, wow, you know, those are some roots, but it's really, it's cool. I'm proud of it all. Like in the sense that I really leaned into wanting to do something that was unique to me and establish something that I could stand behind as an artist. And like just in terms of my career and all that. And I've been really fortunate to be given a platform to write music and make a living off it. You know, that's a blessing.
Well, from myself, Go See Talk listeners, music fans across the globe, Brian, thank you for your time. Thank you for your heart. Thank you for your art. We hope to talk to you soon. Go out and see Escape Room, Tournament of Champions, and F9 and everything else Brian has done. Thanks for your time, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, man.